ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife Science.
A lonely rover toiling among the sands of Mars has now answered an age-old question. If lightning crackles on the red planet and no one hears it, does it still make a sound? Well, with an actual answer to that question, not just a philosophical one, and to tell us what else is happening in the world of science, Dr. Rebecca Allen, co-director of the Space Technology and Industry Institute at Swinburne University of Technology, joins us. Rebecca, good evening to you. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Thank you.
Now, scientists have been looking for electrical activity and lightning on Mars for decades, but now finally NASA has recorded lightning crackling on Mars for the first time. Now, there is a recording. Now, bear in mind, this is from a microphone on the outside of a rover on the Mars surface, millions of kilometres from Earth. So just be a little patient. Have a listen to this. Now, Rebecca, let's play it again, shall we?
Sure.
Okay, there's a rumbling and then there's a little click after the rumbling, and that's the lightning, is it?
Yes. So essentially what we're picking up here, and I love that you explained that, because literally, you know, people are expecting this giant boom of thunder. And really what we're listening to is quite different. And these microphones are like the size of your fingernail. But essentially what's happening is on Mars, we know that the atmosphere is very different from Earth. There's barely any water vapor, and it's very, very dry. So the idea is, how would we, you know, get, what kind of weather phenomenon would you see, and how would we get that at all with the composition of the atmosphere? So these recordings are really important, because what they've captured is, we know that Mars has these literally very large dust devil storms that whirl through. And after two Martian years, which is about four Earth years, they've recorded all of this data from the Perseverance rover, and they've analyzed it. And now what they've been able to do is kind of separate out what is probably just static discharge from the rover, you know, rolling over this, you know, Martian regolith, which might have some pent-up charge on it, to actual charges which are created in these dust storms. So it's not like lightning in the sense where we think of, you know, these massive thunderclouds, you have the hail and you get that friction, which creates the charge imbalance, and then you get lightning. But it is a similar phenomenon where you have these dust storms, and so you're getting that friction and you're getting that charge buildup, and then you're getting that, you know, that zap, that discharge of that. So it's actually extremely important, because now that actually we take that and we work backwards and we say, okay, well, what would the conditions have to be for you to be able to get that buildup of charge, to have that discharge, and to create that lightning?
Yeah, because there is an atmosphere on Mars, isn't it? We know what it's composed of.
So it's mostly carbon dioxide.
Right.
And that has to do with the fact that our atmosphere, it's not just the fact that Earth is bigger, has more gravity, we have tectonic activity, which is really important for, you know, continuing to put gases back in the atmosphere. We have a magnetic field, and that's because our core is still molten, and so it's able to create that dynamo and give us a magnetic field. Mars is smaller, solid core, not much going on. So all of its great molecules and, you know, a lot of it has escaped into space, and it's just not being replenished. So what's left is the, you know, carbon dioxide. And so again, you're not getting these massive, the water cycle rain clouds like you would on Earth, but there is still, you know, an atmosphere, and there is still movement, of that around. I almost said air, and I don't want to, fool people into thinking it is like Earth. But you know, you have enough of that you're able to get these kind of very lightweight. And of course the gravity is different as well. So you get these, dust getting picked up and swirled around.
Interesting. All right. I'll play it for you one more time. Here we go. Well, Well, it does sound a bit like static electricity, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's all a different form of discharge. And I think what's the most interesting about this is one thing that Perseverance is really trying to help us understand is these age-old questions of Mars. We know what its atmosphere is like now, but could it have ever been the kind of atmosphere that did once support these kind of water cycles that we see on Earth? Was there ever, you know, the type of conditions where we would have had at least microbial life on Mars? And so all of these little pieces of information are really kind of helping us fill in that story.
There is water on Mars, isn't there?
There's water ice. And this has been another kind of big, news story recently is, so we've got the rovers and landers on the surface of Mars.
Yeah.
And then orbiting Mars, you have these really sophisticated, basically satellites or spacecraft taking these high resolution images, but also things like a type of a radar or LIDAR. And that can penetrate through the surface. And so the idea is, below the poles or in certain regions, there's thought to potentially be these kind of vast quantities of water underneath the surface. But one of those recent observations is kind of being it's kind of being walked back a little bit because they've been able to point the instrument in a way where they really get a clear kind of LIDAR signature. And it's kind of like glaciers on Earth when they drag over, land for so many eons that you just kind of get these gravel dirt tracks underneath it. So I think it might just be hollow space, but it is a really kind of great question because again, if there's these vast quantities of water under the surface, how would we ever potentially access them and try to characterize them? So it's incredible what we can just even do from orbit around Mars.
Yeah, it's amazing actually. All righty. Now the great question though, Rebecca, is dark matter, is it not? I mean, it makes up, what do they say, 90% of the observable. Well, it's not observable, but they think it maybe makes up 90% of what matter is. But we can't see it. We can't see it. No one's ever been able to really. Well, have we detected it? Maybe. You can only indirectly detect it, can't you?
Yes. Well, that's it. So we call it, astronomers are very creative. We call it dark matter for a reason. We do believe that it makes up about 30% of the universe's total mass.
Oh, okay. There we go.
Energy. Yeah, the other big dark horse here is dark energy, which we won't go down that rabbit hole today. But dark matter is actually, to me, almost a little bit more believable for us because it all goes back to cosmology and the idea that when the universe was still very young, the conditions were such that how galaxies initially seeded and formed, we think that there had to be, this other ingredient there, this thing we call cold dark matter. And then how does that evolve over the, history of our universe today? So we think all of our little galaxies, or at least the majority of them, have these what we call dark matter halos. And so this is just a kind of invisible halo. And what dark matter is made out of, this is a very, very still contested area. And it kind of bridges astronomy, astrophysics, and particle physics because we know that it interacts gravitationally, but it doesn't really interact in the sense how normal matter interacts. And so how do you have something which can still have the influence of gravity, can still help, gas and everything collapse down and hold on to stars and galaxies, but not interact in other ways? And so there have been a few different theories, including WIMPs, or weakly interacting massive particles. So how do you detect something that you can't see and that doesn't interact? And this is where there's been a lot of great work being done, especially with the Center for Dark Matter and Particle Physics. That's the ARC Center of Excellence. So literally looking at how you would build detectors on Earth for those things. But what actually a group of astronomers have done out of Japan, University of Tokyo, is they again are looking at the secondary kind of how you would see the impact of dark matter without directly detecting it. And that's through what we think is called dark matter annihilation. So when you smash two particles together at high enough velocity, they break up into their constituent particles. This is where the Large Hadron Collider has been able to provide some amazing insights. But there's also a thing called annihilation where you have a dark matter particle and you have an antiparticle. And if you have enough density or you just have enough of these particles, after a certain amount of time, They'll collide with each other and they'll annihilate, and you'll get this shower of energetic, photons and particles, other little tiny particles. So what they believe they've done is actually to detect a gamma ray, which is the most energetic type of photon. And they think that they've actually been able to detect this in the galaxy's halo. So this is an area where there's not a lot of the galaxy's matter that we can see is concentrated, the most of that being at the galaxy's center where their supermassive black hole is. But things get a little tricky there trying to detect this dark matter annihilation because there's just so much traffic. And so what these astronomers believe is that by looking out in the halo and finding this gamma ray signal that doesn't really seem to match any other kind of known candidates, that potentially this could be that elusive dark matter annihilation signature.
Right.
Still a lot of question marks, the detection itself, whether that detection, is high enough above a threshold to really be significant, that reproducibility, that's what it all kind of comes down to. So first of all, can we reproduce this detection? This is from a gamma ray high energy telescope, space telescope. So can we reproduce that? And then if that signal is there, can we try to locate it in potentially other galaxies, or really trying to understand exactly what the source of that is?
There's a big Nobel Prize waiting,
Absolutely.
talk about luck. A man from Victoria found a big rock, which he's hung on to for years because he thought it had gold in it.
Yeah.
Turns out that it wasn't – well, it was valuable, but it wasn't gold because –
Yes, because it was from space. And this is what I love these stories. So actually I've had the opportunity to speak with a few people who are meteorite enthusiasts who look for them. And Victoria, obviously, there's these gold fields, big regions where gold was historically mined. And so prospectors will go out and, they'll look for nuggets, and there's still a lot of gold out there to be found. And so this gentleman found a very large specimen, and he knew he had the right instinct. He knew that it was special, but he literally tried like every kind of tool you can think of to crack it open. And it was just so hard that nothing was able to, to break it apart. So he knew he needed some more help. And so he went to the museum, and they, they get a lot of these kind of inquiries, but they use a technique where they're able to use a special type of saw, and they literally carve a slice off of it. And then they pretty much knew immediately that it was a meteorite. So from the outside, a lot of these, it could just look like a giant hunk of iron, really, because you see on the surface, they're very kind of hard to tell. You just pick it up and you realize this thing is a lot heavier than it should be for a rock this size. That's your first clue, is the density. But then they could see within it immediately these they're called chondrites, and this is where this material has been heated in our early solar system, and then it's kind of globbed together the way that it's reformed back together. It's a very technical term, globbing back together, but it's what it does. So it leaves these chondrites, which are these little nodules inside that you can really quickly identify, and then they sent that off, and it was confirmed that it was in fact one of the largest meteorites that's been found in Victoria. Of course, there's some other prime examples of very large meteorites that have been found here. So it's pretty spectacular that, someone in their own kind of neck of the woods.
Is it valuable?
I tell you what, it's valuable money-wise because they're rare. Yeah. This one in particular is a more of a metallic asteroid meteorite, which makes sense because it survived reentry into our atmosphere. So more often than not, these are the more iron-rich ones. But these are also more rare in our solar system, the most common being carbon-based meteors and asteroids. And so it's interesting from that perspective, but it's very valuable from a scientific perspective because for us to be able to actually get a sample that we can analyze, literally one of the most pristine objects in our solar system from the very early stages. These are so important for us when it comes to planetary formation.
I'm sure it's right. I'm not sounding not wanting to sound crass here, but is it more valuable than gold? Probably is.
Oh yes, absolutely. I don't know how well it would go if you tried to use it as currency, but absolutely, a lot more valuable than gold.
Rebecca, always great to talk. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Of course.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.